This is Mary. We'll be telling her story tonight. I had the privilege of her being my sponsor and taking me through my first four step. Mary, thank you so much for all that you do, and I can't wait to hear you.
Yay, Mary.
My name is Mary, and I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. And I want y'all to understand something. I got sober at the Biscayne Room a long time ago, so that whole thing about if you're offended, basically what I was told is too bad. If you drink, go back out, you'll come back. We're not really worried about that. It's not our stuff. We're here to save lives. And I showed up to save my life. So that's my disclaimer. And I did read the rules, Tim, you know, and I will try to be good, but I cannot guarantee that an expletive or two might not fall out of my mouth. Take it to your sponsor if you get offended and pray for me. I definitely need that. My name is Mary. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. My home group is the We've Had Enough group at Biscayne Tuesday night at 8, and my sobriety date is July the 20th, 1987. I think there's some important things, some important qualifiers that, you know, we all just have to do. Just briefly, I was born here in Atlanta. I feel like I'm ancient because I remember when the hospital was called DeKalb General Hospital and I had two stories. So that's how long I've been around. Tinsley remembers that. The home that I grew up in was not an alcoholic home. My dad had another issue, but the point was that if you grow up in a household where there is a problem, there are certain skills that you develop. And those skills don't necessarily go away just after you get sober, right? You know how to, if you hear certain words, you know how to duck, scatter, and hide quick because it's fixing to get real ugly. You know how to walk into a room and just try to be invisible. You know how to walk into a situation and just get the temperature of the room because you're just not sure what may or may not happen. So you learn how to judge that stuff real quickly. It becomes part of second nature. Funny enough, you know, and it's funny, I share this story because the alcohol experience in my household, it's funny to me now, but my dad would cut the grass and he would buy a six pack, and so he would drink a beer after he cut the grass, and then that six pack would sit in the refrigerator for days, weeks, whatever. So it wasn't just, and my grandmother was a teetotaler, so just alcohol was not part of my household, and it wasn't really part of my world. Until my first drink, I'm the youngest of four. I always like to say there are three alcohol, my mom and dad had three alcoholic drug addicts and one neurotic. So that's my basis. I think it's important to share about your first drink. My first drink, I was 15 years old, and I had a friend named Kelly Merritt, whose mom owned the flower shop down there at Five Points. This is the 80s, so you'll have to remember this. Kelly drove a Chevrolet Capri Classic. Now, this was when they were the boxy ones, and they were like two-tone, half maroon, half orange on the bottom. Y'all remember those? And so we were going to a football game, and so Kelly had stolen a couple beers out of her dad's stash and had them in the trunk, so we went out. Now, y'all think about this. This honestly is really gross, that those beers had been in the trunk like all day long, and after the football game, we crack them, so they were just nasty, just nasty. But it wasn't the point. The point was, all of a sudden, I'm driving around in an Impala on a Friday night in Atlanta, Georgia, drinking a beer, me and the girls, and it was like I had arrived. I am here. This is cool. My second, this is an important event. As a junior in high school, I was part of the French club, so we went to France for 10 days. You know, being a, you look back and you know there's just marks where you have a, where you are an alcoholic, right? our group got paired with a group from California, so we were very different. We came from Atlanta. They came from, like, Beverly Hills. So we were just, like, completely different people. In Europe, you can drink a lot younger than you can in America. So we proceeded to get completely smashed on red wine and beer. Not a good combination. So I later proceeded to, you know, throw up basically all over the hotel room. With a meeting, apparently everybody went running around the hotel, and there was a meeting the next morning that my French teacher was so angry, I thought her head was going to explode. And this one, by the skin of my teeth, did not get put on a plane to fly back to America. But God has a way of working things out, because you know what we were doing on that day? We got on a bus. We went to tour the Dom Perignon vineyards, I guess, for lack of a better term. Now, you have to understand something. The Dom Perignon cellars are way out in the country. You're on this French country road in a bus, and I thought I was going to die. Now, if I'd have done... See, I learned a lot after I got sober. That would have been super helpful during my drinking. Because at the end of the tour, they gave you samples. And I was just like, whoa, no, I don't want that. What I learned after I got sober, I should have drank 5 or 6 of the samples. I would have felt better. But I didn't know that at the time. You learn a lot of stuff in AA. But my catalyst was this. Ultimately, my senior year in high school, and I want you to understand something. The Big Book talks about women alcoholics, that women have a tendency that once we hit the barrier, we just fall off the cliff. And some of us just run hardcore and jump. And that was my variety of alcoholism. I just jumped. So as a senior in high school, I'm alcoholic. An addict. So, you know, the rules really don't apply to me. They are suggestions. You're right, Tim. They are suggestions. I approached it like this. First period was meant for me and my best friend Stephanie to go to breakfast. Second period, we had to go to Avondale, wake up TC, Stephanie's boyfriend. Third period, I would show up because I did like Mr. Bird and I learned a lot about economics from Mr. Bird. Fourth period was lunch. Fifth period was chorus, and I was the vice president of the chorus, so I had a responsibility to have some integrity and show up as an example. Sixth period, we might stay, we might not. Well, you know, DeKalb County had an issue with this. So, I got, you know, in trouble. So what their genius plan was to put me in the attendance office. At least if they made me work in the office during the fourth period, I could at least, they knew where I was for a block of time. Because I had to be there. I'm sitting outside the attendance principal and the discipline principal's office, right, running the desk. Well, I did pay attention in economics. And at that time, this was old school, you had a piece of paper, and check-ins and check-outs were done by, like, a stamp. So I got very industrious, and I just one day just took a stack of papers and the stamp, and I just started stamping check-out passes. Okay, so I started selling them, right? So dumbass me sold them for, like, a quarter a piece. Man, I could have made bank if I'd have been, like, $5 a shot. I could have made a fortune. The problem was, there was about a 2-week period, there was this rash of unexplained check-ins and check-outs. The people showed up with the slip. It was a legitimate slip. But there was no backup or excuse. So, you know, they pretty much figured out that it was me. So the principal in charge of that was a gentleman named Mike Kosmarski. I love Mr. Kosmarski. So he pulls me in. We sit down. And he said, here's the deal. He said, now, you remember, being a good alcoholic, you know, we're going to blow it up. Not at the beginning. We blow it up at the end, like right at the end. I am a quarter. This is back when we were on the quarter system. This is my senior year. I'm a quarter away from graduating. and I'm going to blow this thing sky high. So he says, I'm going to start expulsion proceedings on you unless you transfer out of here and go to open campus. So he picks up the phone and he calls my mom. Now, my mom, in her own recovery, has started going to some, I don't know, Al-Anon, SLA-Anon, some Anon program. You know, where the real sick ones are. Mr. Kosnarski calls her, and this is my mom. She really got this part down good. She goes, as he explains what's going on, she says to him, and I quote, Mr. Kosnarski, throw the book at her. Click. Ooh, maybe this is kind of serious. Because all that was going on in the background was this, was that the summer before I became a senior, I went to California to stay with my brother. And here's the thing. This was another very important thing that I learned about alcohol was I was 17, so, and my sister-in-law was in the Air Force. We lived at, they lived in San Pedro, which was right next to a big base in San Pedro. So I started dating one of the airmen, and then they found out somehow, somebody told, that the airman was dating an underage 17-year-old. So, you know, in my mind, this was like, so he told me, you know, that he couldn't see me anymore, that I couldn't come to his room on the base and So, you know, in my mind, this is like a scene from An Officer and a Gentleman, right? The true love that torn up. My cousin's my sister-in-law's cousin came and got me. We went to her house and watched Officer and a Gentleman and proceeded to drink peach schnapps and had a long, torrid cry about how I had, love had been ripped right from my heart. You know, we can get a little dramatic. But that started when I landed back. The reason I couldn't show up at DeKalb County, we had an issue, was because I started dating a guy in Clarkston, Georgia, at the auto parts store, which led me down. I know how to fix a car, and I learned a lot of other things, too. But essentially, I got involved in an older crowd, and we did a lot of drinking, and we did a lot of powder cocaine, and we did a whole lot of stuff. So basically, here's what happened. I did graduate. I did go to open campus. I did graduate by the skin of my teeth. I did graduate. I moved out and moved in with my druggy boyfriend, who happened to be a trust fund baby. All he had to do, because he had a house in Clarkson that the trust owned that his dad lived in, and the only requirement for him to live in the house, he was about 10 years older than I was, the only requirement was that he have a job. So he got a job at the liquor store. So what I'm telling you is we did not have a liquor cabinet. We had a liquor wall. Literally, he built shelves floor to ceiling with bottles 3 deep. Had I remained, I would have killed myself. And I got a job at Stone Mountain Park in the cash control place part. So what I did is I printed all the paychecks for Stone Mountain Park at 3:00 in the morning. And, you know, when you have a man who's supporting you because, you know, you're working and he's trying to help you with your career, he would pack me a lunch, you know, so we had an eight ball, something in a thermos. I would go to work, print paychecks, me and a couple of the Stone Mountain cops, we're good buddies, so we would drive around at night. You know you screwed up when the director, and I'm not talking about your boss or your boss's boss or your boss's boss, when the man who's in charge of the money of Stone Mountain Park shows up on a Sunday morning at 5:00 in the morning, you're fired. Like, in a real, like, don't ever, ever, ever show up at this park again, ever kind of a way. I had a tumultuous physical altercation with the guy that I lived with, and basically I left with by the skin of my teeth and with my life. So what happened? I ended up at home. Now, my dad and I have the same birthday. So my 18th birthday and his 50th birthday, we all get together like as a family, and we're going to go for a big family celebration. We go. We get done. I'm ready to head out the door. And you have to understand the time period. Interventions and stuff like that were like just becoming like a thing. So my whole family, I'm ready to head out the door. My dad's like, I've got the keys. You're not going anywhere. So we sit down as a family, and we're going to deal with this family problem together. So my mom pulls out this little case and then unzips the case. Now, honestly, this was her case. I had, like, stole it. So she unzips the case, and she pulls out a mirror and a razor blade and a straw and this little corner of a Ziploc sandwich bag that has just some little white stuff in it. Quite frankly, she was more pissed about the case than she was about what was in it, if you really want to know the truth. So what I was told was this, was that you have 24 hours to decide. If you want help, we will help you. If you don't want help, then you have till Friday, and my dad was very specific about this, to get everything that you bought out of this house. And as far as we're concerned, you're dead and we're done. Lose our number. Now, let me say, I do want to say this, because when you get sober and they talk about don't forget your last drunk, it, for me, when I hear that, it isn't about the specifics, you know, because a lot of that stuff, you're just like, yeah, they're just mad, they'll get over it. Because I really didn't think I was going to have to go, because literally off her treatment, I packed my stuff in a laundry basket. Like, I'm just going to put it in the basket, and then we're going to bring the basket back up, because they're not going to get me. What I think they're talking about, or how I interpret what they're talking about, is that feeling. Because that morning when Walt Bucket walked in and fired me, and I got in the car and drove, it was a beautiful summer morning as the sun's coming up. I felt absolutely nothing. There was nothing in here. It was like a shell. Absolute emotional, just demoralization. I don't care. I just don't care. I don't know how to feel. I don't care. Now, there are a lot of things that go with that and a lot of other things that happen and that, you know, that we could spend all night long going into. Ultimately, I went into treatment. Now, I want you to understand something. You have to remember this is back in the 80s, and there were treatment centers on every corner. They had the Cadillac treatment centers where, you know, they talked about your inner child, and they gave you a bear, and they talked about all this stuff about, you know, why it was everybody else's fault, and there was a pool, and y'all could get massages and all that. That's not the treatment center I went to. I went to a place called Straight. They're not in, but it was of that treatment modality, which is we will break you to the bones that you are, and you will start from scratch because you're nothing but a piece of shit. So that's where I went to treatment. And you, literally, you could not walk by yourself. You had to have somebody as a newcomer. You wore jeans, you wore pants, and they gripped you by the back of your pants, and you walked around with somebody holding the back of your pants to be seated in a chair. And the only time you had by yourself was on the other, well, really not. If you took a shower, because you didn't live in a building, you lived in host homes. People that were in the treatment center opened up their home and they had host homes. So you could be moved at any point in time. Today you're with the Williams, tomorrow you're with the Hansons, tomorrow you're with the Reynolds, next day you're with the Talons. So you never knew. Constantly kind of off track. So you didn't even take a shower by yourself. Your old camera was watching you take a shower. So it was very hardcore. And what is funny was the first night there, on Fridays and Monday, was open meetings. And what open meeting was, all the, they called them phasers, because there were five phases. All the phasers sat on one side of the room, and all the parents and family sat on the other side of the room facing each other. And you had to wait, you had to earn the right to talk. So at open meeting, when the microphone went to your family, you stood up and they stood up. And they talked to you over the microphone, and you couldn't say anything. You just sat there with your mouth shut. You're going to freaking take it. You know, it can get ugly. So, you know, my mom gets the microphone and she's like, you know, she does that whole mom thing like, honey, I love you and you can do this. And I'm, you know, this, you're going to be good. Just, you know, this is wonderful and you're going to be fine. And I just love you so much. They passed the microphone to my dad. And my dad's like this. He goes, I'm paying the bill. I hope you do something. And hands the microphone to the next person. This is not good. While I was in treatment, I lost my driver's license. Not lost it. I mean, it was taken away from me because of point suspension. And at that time, I think the points were like 15. Now, y'all, hell, I was 18 years old. I got my driver's license at 16. That's a lot of tickets in 2 years if you've, like, maxed your points out. Unfortunately, thank God for a Clarkston cop who called me about 3 o'clock in the morning, and after I promised to do certain things, if he wouldn't write me a ticket, he was like, baby, I'm just going to follow you home, okay? Okay, we'll just see you. I'm just going to see you home. So I was in treatment for 9 months, and I copped out. I left against advice. Because my dad, my druggy daddy dad, was just like, I'm tired of this shit, and I'm driving to Marietta every day, and all these girls in my household, and I'm old, and I'm done, and I've just had enough. And if you want out, you can get out. Cool. Really, what it was is my dad had to go to meetings, too, and, like, do moral inventories and all that, and he was like, screw this shit. I'm paying the bill. That's all I'm obligated to do. I am not, because I found out later he got stood up in a whole lot of parent groups. And confronted. He was like, no, we ain't doing that. I'm out. It's important. I say all that because that was my first experience of recovery. So what happened? I had no driver's license. It's me, a dad. I called the phone. I knew this. I could not talk to anybody that I went to treatment with because I was completely cut off from them. All the rest of my friends had gone because I'm 18 and they all went to UGA and they're all dating the guy in the red Corvette who I'm supposed to be dating. And that's just another tragic thing that has occurred. I knew I had memorized the steps. I'd never been to a meeting. So I called the visiting room and this voice answered the phone and I was like, it's Big George if you know Big George. But it was like, this was like this Don Johnson sort of Miami Vice kind of really sexy voice. And I was like, shit, yeah, okay. So I showed up at the Saturday night meeting and dropped off. And I'm telling y'all, that's the longest walk. Because I walked in there and I knew nobody. But here's what happened. I did not understand. I mean, I kind of understood what they were talking about because I'd been in treatment. But what happened is I sat there and I had that sense of belonging. Like, okay, I understand what they're talking about, kind of. They kind of think crazy like I think. I get that. I don't hear this anywhere else. I did what every good newcomer does. And God bless this. But I immediately, there was a really good-looking roofer that was like, hey, would you like to go out? And I was like, yeah, absolutely, sure, let's do that. So I'm just going to say this, and it may be against popular, but, you know, 13-stepping did save my life because God bless that man. I had 9 months of sobriety. He had a year and a half. He taught me how to go to meetings. He taught me what a sponsor was like. He was like, you need a sponsor. I was like, well, you could do it. And he's like, no, that's not how it works. You really get in trouble if you do that. Okay. Found a sponsor. Got involved. And I rode for a long time on the fellowship of this program because that, quite frankly, was all that I could comprehend. It's all I could comprehend was the people. And I got busy doing some service work. And I will say this because this is important if you're a newcomer. I signed up for the job of doing the food at the dances at the Biscayne Room. You know, and here's the thing. Alcoholics are the most ungrateful bitchin', act like they're a bunch of princesses, want everything for nothing, right? Like, I got $100, and this is back then, I got $100 to feed the, this place is packed for 3 hours of people dancing and singing, and they're hungry, and they went, I got $100 to feed y'all, and y'all gonna start bitching. And complaining, well, why did you have that? Why didn't you do this? Why did you do that? It's like, good Lord. However, one day, one night at about 11 o'clock when the neighbors were restless, it was hot, and there was no food left, a man walked in with a ham. A ham. Out of that deal, I got a ham, and later I got a husband. It is hard to tell you what has happened to me in 39 years of sobriety. It's hard to tell. I can lay the groundwork and tell you why I qualify and why we are here and what we do. I got sober young, so there's a lot of things that I grew up in this program. I mean, I grew up here. I got a job. I got an apartment. I got married. I had three babies. The only thing that I can share with you is that, number one, I got sober the old-fashioned way, or the old-school way. At that period of time in life, they did not say, hey, I'm going to go through the big book with you. What my sponsor said is, can you read? And I was like, yeah, I did graduate, thank you. Barely, but I did. She goes, good, here's this book, read it. If you have any questions, call me. So this whole modern thing about I'm going to sit down and have my sponsor read the big book to me is foreign to me. It's about somebody else assuming responsibility. Because later on my sponsor said, yeah, they're doing that. That's just stupid because the only person you're going to get is that person. You're only going to get Jan Warbinson's version of the big book. If you want to know about the big book, guess what? Go to big book meetings. If you want to learn about the steps, guess what? Go to step meetings. You need the collective experience of all those alcoholics in there because guess what? Every single one is going to be different. That's what you need to do. In this time that I've been sober, I will tell you this. Y'all have saved my life in more ways than I can count and more ways than one. As I look back, y'all granted me a couple of things right out of the beginning. Number one, y'all told me that the only person that gets to decide if I'm an alcoholic is me. It's me to make that decision. Quality of my sobriety depends entirely upon who? Me. If my sobriety is shitty and I got drunk, that's on me. Because there's lots of places here that you can go and get help. I've sat in a lot of meetings. And I've listened to a lot of people. And what the value of meetings for me has always been the ability to take a little bit of what you said, and 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 put it together in this combined thing, and that's how I've learned to have a relationship with God of my understanding. Thank God I got sober with the old guys, because basically they were like, we don't care who your God is, don't want to freaking hear it, and it's not appropriate in these meetings. All we want to know is that you have one and it's not yourself. Okay, cool. I can do that. Check. So my experience along the way is, you know, I heard what you said and I thought, you know, I might try that. I went through a period of some real spiritual dryness and I heard somebody talking about it because, you know, life happens to all of us. Guess what? We get divorced. Have you ever been through a divorce? It's horrible. And as a result, my first husband was, we did not know this, but he was He was diagnosed with cancer, and within a week of the within days of the diagnosis, he was gone. So I'm looking at three babies trying to figure out, how the hell am I going to raise y'all? This program's given me tools, and you guys have always given me everything that I needed. After we buried Jerry, we went to Florida to the Biscayne Room, has their September, everybody gathers on the beach in Panama City in September. We left the funeral on Wednesday and drove to Panama City on Thursday morning. I woke up in more fear than I've ever been in my whole life. How am I going to do this? And I took my scared ass down to morning meditation, and Joyce Pruitt had the coffee ready, and she goes, sit your ass down. I sat, because that's about all I could do. And she made me a cup of coffee, and she's like, what? I said, I'm terrified. How do I do this? And she was like, stop being a dumbass. She goes, you're going to do this today just like you did yesterday, and you did the day before that, and you did the day before that. We do this program one day at a time. It's not like they just appeared and you just became their mother yesterday. Oh, thank you. I went through another experience, and I ended up in a meeting in Alabama, and life was falling apart. I mean falling apart. And I ended up in Alabama, and I went to a meeting, and I just threw it on the table. Didn't know these people from Adam's House Cat. And I'm telling you, this lady in that meeting, who I'd never seen before, I don't remember her name, and I've never seen her again, took me outside, and I'm telling y'all, I had double-digit sobriety, took me out after that meeting, we sat and talked, and that lady saved my freaking life that day. That's what we do for each other. There have been a lot of times I have gone through the last 2 years of my life have been very difficult because I've got a situation family-wise that has to do with money and a business and a 91-year-old mother and a sister who ain't real well that's gotten really, really ugly and really, really nasty. And in conversation, Rosemary was my sponsor, and in conversation with Rosemary, I called Rosemary, we laid it out, we're talking through it, I'm mom's power of attorney, I need to do what I'm supposed to do here, but they're doing this and that and the other. Rosemary, if you didn't know her, we all miss her. Here's what Rosemary said, and y'all gonna have to forgive this, because this is a direct quote. Rosemary said, fuck 'em, just do what you know you're supposed to do and take care of your mom. That'll be all right. That's exactly what I needed to hear. Because this alcoholic was all worried about, well, we make this move and we make that move. What's that move going to happen? And da-da-da-da-da. And I've got to balance. And right now, take care of your mama. That's what you're supposed to do. Every tool I have ever needed, and the funny part about it is this, has been given to me when I have been willing to receive. Always. And my relationship with God has been based on communication. But I celebrated 39 years back in July, and a lady that I've known for a long time, but she's not in my regular circle, shared her story. But before she shared her story, she walked by me while I was sitting in the chair, and she put her hand out and dropped a 39-year chip in my hand. And on the chip, it had my numbers. And on the back of it was the third step prayer. And around the edge on one of them, it said, trust God, clean house, help others. I'm telling y'all, I don't have it on today because this dress doesn't have a pocket. I have carried that chip in my pocket for the last couple weeks because that's what I've needed to do. And that's what I've needed to be reminded. Trust God. Clean house, help others. The rest of it, as the old timers would tell me, is just none of my damn business. I know what I'm supposed to do. This program has given me a lot of latitude and a lot of room. And it's always told me this. This is what the old timers said. You can do anything in this room and in this world that you want to do. Anything. As long as you're prepared to pay the consequences. And if you're not prepared to pay the consequences, maybe you ought to think about it. most of us do it anyway, and then cry about the consequences. But this program has always given me the choice, and that's the most important thing about this program. You gave me the choice to walk in here and diagnose myself. The fact that I was 18 when I got here, yeah, we can be screwed up at 18. Y'all know. I got the choice to diagnose myself. I got the choice to walk to meetings and find out. And here's the girl. Y'all, I'm a Biscayne Room girl, you know, because I grew up during the Battle of the Biscayne Room and that and all of that. So I come to y'all's house occasionally. But, you know, there was a period of time where Maggie was real mad at that. And so, you know, you just didn't go over there because you had to choose. What I learned there and what I've learned in meetings like this and other meetings is that I always get the choice. And what I was told was that if you want to learn from nothing else but other people's experience, don't drink. See what happened. Everything else I have done and paid the consequences for, but I've learned and I've watched and I've not drank. That I haven't done. And that's been about choice. And they nailed it in my head. If you drink again, do not come crying to me with some trauma story about, ooh, you chose to. End of the story. There's no, well, I slipped. No, you got drunk because you wanted to. Be honest. That's what I was met with. And those were the measurements that I was given. And that thought in my mind is I've never wanted anybody. Number one, I don't ever want to be 30 days sober again ever in my life. Ever, 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 ever. Because that is some sick, crazy shit right there. I don't ever want to be that. And number two, I did not ever want to have to walk in the Biscayne Room and have somebody look at me like, no, you just chose to get drunk. Go talk to me in that bullshit about, oh, I had a slip or I realized. No, you chose it. So shut up, sit down, what are you going to do about it? This program has always given me the right to choose what it was I was going to do and take responsibility for it. Because if your sobriety is shitty, that's on you. If it's worthwhile, it's because you put the effort and the time and you did the work. And I didn't come here. I came here to get a life and to get better. And by making that choice, it's because I've done the work. Not that I'm all fabulous. Most times, guess what? The pain outweighed the pleasure, and I showed up on the door broken and frustrated and hurting, and all of a sudden y'all said, okay, are you done hurting? Yeah, I am. Okay, let's do some work about it. Okay, cool, let's do. But I've always been given the right to choose, and I've always had it sit on my shoulders. And I am responsible for my sobriety. But most importantly, those steps give us all kinds of tools. But at the end of the day, when your head monster is dragging you around by your thoughts, when my head monster is dragging me around my thoughts, what I remember is that the tools are the same at 39 years of sobriety as they were when I got sober. And the basis line is this. Trust God, clean house, help others. And if I can do that, then I'm going to put my head on the pillow tonight, sober. And we'll try it again all over tomorrow. So thank y'all for letting me share.
First I slipped, and then I quit. To a hope-filled dream. Rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promise. All is sometimes quickly, sometimes slow. We get just what we need on a broad highway. God walks by, we walk eternally. Take me where the